welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we're having one of those exciting host-only episodes that people love so much.
They're the best ones.
They are. We just full, we have to make up in content what we lack in celebrity. So anyway, here we are in minute 41. And Hal, why don't you catch us up to what's going on with poor Steve running through Brooklyn?
All right, minute 41. Steve leaps a chain link fence and runs into the street, pursuing Heinz Kruger in the stolen taxi cab. In the taxi, Kruger weaves through the narrow streets filled with traffic. Looking over his shoulder, he sees Rogers is gaining on him. Kruger turns toward the Brooklyn wharves. Steve tries a new tactic, leaping onto the many cars and trucks in front of him. Eventually, he lands on the roof of the taxi. Kruger saws at the steering wheel, trying to shake Steve off the roof. He turns down a narrow alley, headed for Dumbo, down under the Manhattan Bridge overpass. Kruger still can't shake Steve. He fires several shots through the roof at Steve, but Rogers evades the shots. Distracted, Kruger crashes into a truck, sending the taxi tumbling end over end. The taxi door flies off. The taxi comes to a rest with Kruger staggering out of the cab.
Wow. So many references to other movies in this scene.
Yes,
particularly, exactly. I was thinking of the rhino horn from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where the rhino is attacking through the roof of the freight train that young Indiana Jones
is
fighting in the circus train.
It's a good callback. I like that. Yeah. It says something about Steve's amazing reflexes that in the time it takes a bullet to go through the roof of the car and, 4 inches toward his body, he's able to dodge it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Or he's clairvoyant or something. I don't know how he's dodging these bullets through the roof of the car.
I'm telling you, that serum, don't knock it if you haven't tried it, Brian.
Yeah.
Speaking of the serum, what I love about this minute is it's the first time we see Captain America in action. We see we get a good gauge of Steve's capabilities. We see how he can jump. We see how fast he can run. In the previous minute, we saw him smashing through glass windows and running away with an "I'm sorry." It's really a neat piece of storytelling that sort of outlines his capabilities. We get a sense of how strong he is, how fast he is. We see that he can't fly. He's not super human, but he's pretty superhuman. I think it's a neat catalog of here are the things you can expect of Captain America in the future.
That's a great point, because we don't, we don't have a lot of exposition prior to this, for the first act of the film. And we don't have somebody saying, okay, I'm going to give you this shot, and this is exactly what you will be able to do and won't be able to do. We just know it's going to make you, super in the Marvel sense, at least.
Yeah, but that's never defined.
It's never defined. It's not like the opening credits to the $6 million man, where we can make it better than he was before.
And you see him running literally 60 miles an hour. What we get out of this minute of the movie is Steve can run about as fast as a car on a city street. So 25 miles an hour, something like that. He can jump from car top to car top to car top. So he's nimble and he can leap, 25, 30 feet, about as much as a championship long jumper can jump. I think it's great. And as a comic book fan, it was really neat for me to see this, to see Captain America in action. It reminded me very much, or later on I was reminded of this, when there's a minute in the first Avengers movie that shows Steve kind of catapulting off a bus that's going over a ledge, and he just flies through the air and he does a graceful flip and he lands on his feet. It's like, that's Captain America. And this minute is Captain America to me as an old comic book fan. It's like, yes, that's what he should look like when he's doing those things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm always impressed not only by Captain America, but Steve Rogers' clothing, because apparently he managed to put on old skinny Steve's t-shirt, and he still somehow managed to slide in, or he still manages to wear the khaki pants. He doesn't Hulk out. There's nothing shredded about it. It's just he's shredded, not the pants.
But he is doing this whole thing barefoot, which I think is a superpower all on its own.
I wondered very much about that. If they, because I've seen, behind the scenes, maybe you guys know the answer to this, but the effects people and makeup people will create like silicone feet that look like real feet for people to wear in these barefoot scenes. And I wonder if Chris Evans is wearing silicone feet or if they just really swept that street before he started running down it.
I mean, if you look at where he's when he lands on the taxi, it does. I can't tell if his feet are dirty or if he's wearing something underneath them.
Yeah.
But it is a nice view of what we now know is Dale Street in Manchester, and
That's
it really
right.
is impressive how much they as Fab Santino was telling us in the previous episode that this is a street that is. I guess not easily, but it possible to redress. But the more you look at it, especially when you're clicking through it Zapruder style, it is very British looking in the background. Not very Brooklyn. But for passing scenes and for the first floor, it's just very Brooklyn-y.
Right. And never in a million years, without knowing that, if you'd asked me, hey, where do you think that was shot? It's, well, it looks like either New York or a very New York-y back lot somewhere. But it looked too big to be a back lot. So I mean, I wouldn't have, I could have made 100 guesses and never gotten to, anywhere in the UK or Liverpool.
I don't trust my eyes anymore in anything.
That's right. It's
I don't
all.
believe anything I see, but they did
Yeah.
a very nice job of this. And Jim, I always appreciate your insights as someone who knows Brooklyn because I do not know New York. But I love your mention the description of the Dumbo, the down under the Manhattan Bridge overpass. A landmark unknown to me, but apparently meant caught your eye.
It's a common phrase, but it's mostly used by I want to I hate using the word hipsters, but it this is mo it's more of a recent use than a previous use. But Dumbo is very much a common term for where you're meeting Dumbo, and that it's a kind of artsy thing. There's a series of places, like warehouses, lofts, and things like that that used to be used for shipping and stuff. And it's all been turned into, a walking. I mean, there's bars, there's restaurants. It's all revitalized. It's also some very pricey apartments and townhouses that way because the view from there toward Manhattan is amazing. I mean, if you've seen the end of Gangs of New York, there's a scene that's taken from near Dumbo. But a lot of movies put people there because you get the whole background of Manhattan. I mean, it's like Barney, the opening of Barney Miller and things,
Oh, sure.
that you see this beautiful waterfront, and it's just amazing. I'm sorry, I'm being distracted because as I'm clicking through the clip, I'm noticing that they're announcing Route 22 in New York, which that is not where Route 22 starts. It is in Brooklyn. It's in Bronx. But anyway,
This whole
nitpicking.
operation's crumbling, isn't it?
Yeah,
It's
it's
all
just
falling down around our ears.
as you start flipping through it, it's like I grew up in off of Route 22 in Brewster, New York, and I've also grown up on the U.S. Highway 22, which goes through New Jersey, and neither of them go through where this part of Brooklyn is. So.
I think you found the one improbable part of this movie.
Yeah,
Right. Yeah,
it's
everything
well.
else.
I keep thinking this is one of the, as we're eventually going to be exposed to the multiverse in the MCU. I think this is probably a sign that this is a multiverse. This is not Earth 616. It's something else.
It's identical to ours, except Route 22 is somewhere else.
Yes.
Right,
Yeah.
exactly. It goes from Brooklyn to Liverpool
Yeah.
and then makes a
And
loop and
off
comes
to
back
Manchester.
around.
Yeah.
I don't want to I don't want to jump ahead pretty much all the way to the end of the movie, but something that actually struck me, and well, we should talk about this in that minute, but that's a long time from now. Before we started today, I was just taking a quick look at the Internet Movie Cars database site because there was one car in particular I was trying to identify it. I don't think they have it there, but when you choose the movie, you've got this grid of thumbnails, images from different scenes. And I'd never thought of this. I hadn't noticed this, but this whole scene, we're talking the white shirt and the khaki pants and everything down the middle of the street, kind of in the canyon of the buildings. There's a nearly identical thumbnail, but the vehicle shown there is a 2006 Toyota Prius, and it's the framing, lighting, everything except the color palette. At the end of the film, when we see Steve, you know, running around Times Square and things, it's just, it's amazing to me. These two thumbnails could have been like, one could have been a storyboard for another. They match perfectly. So if I forget that, when we get to that part of the film, we can bring it up again, but I keep his outfit is basically the same in the thumbnails. I'm looking at one shot. He's running away from the camera, the other he's running toward, but that's just, you know, what they happen to choose to highlight a particular car.
And I bet they filmed them on the same day, you know, just took the old cars out, put the new one in.
I thought the ending was truly shot in Times Square, but I guess I don't know that for sure. We'll
have to quiz cross Joe that on bridge that.
When we come to it.
We'll research that, but I believe the actual scene in Times Square was shot in Times Square, and they managed to shut it down for 15 minutes and get that shot what I remember. But we'll research that when we get to it.
There might be a Times Square in Manchester. We're not sure yet.
Right. Nothing would surprise me. But
I'm amazed in the UK there are that many 40s cars. I mean, maybe they're just showing them going the other way and flipping the cars around and reusing cars. But it's an astonishing number of American-made cars.
Yeah, that's the key, is American-made. I mean, you expect to see all kinds of Austin A40s and Wolseleys all sorts of, you know, great, great old period British stuff as easily accessible, but
I see a huge. There's piles up. There's Pontiacs. I mean, I'm seeing a bunch of Chevys. There are several.
There's Cadillacs.
Yeah,
Buicks.
There's even a Model T, I think, or a Model A. There's a Model A that flies by, I think. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's also, if you go to for those of you following at home, if you go to Second 19, I think we see the shortest cameo. I don't know who the character actor was, but it's an old fellow watching Steve run over the top of his car, and he is in the movie for all of maybe, to say 2 seconds would be a lot. I think he's in there for a second and a half at Second 19. It's just an older fellow wearing a fedora, and Steve runs over the middle of his, I think it's a Studebaker. I think he's running over a Studebaker, because it looks like that, you know, the Studebaker had that the winged nose ornament.
So you know what you need to do now, Jim. We need to get this guy on the podcast.
Track him down, yes.
We need to find him. He's got to be somewhere.
He could be the casting director. Get me in the movie, okay.
Casting director's maybe, father, yeah.
He could be the mayor of Manchester. I'll sign the paper if you put me in your movie. Exactly. I'll close down Dale Street for a week.
And he, like so many other people we've talked to, gets to say forever that he was in Captain America.
and rightly so, with proper pride. Just going back to the cars, I wouldn't be surprised if Marvel just put 20 cars on a boat and shipped them over there.
That's also quite possible. That's
probably the easiest way of doing it, just drop them into a container.
From talking to Fab, they had money to spend on this thing.
Yeah. Right. It was great talking with him, because just understanding the scale, that it was a lot more than just doing a couple of indie films or being on a soap opera. They trying to redress an entire street in England to look like Brooklyn and Paramount was, yes, let's do this. Astonishing. Any thoughts on the, I mean, I know that the color palette is kind of limited, but that yellow taxi really stands out. Brian. So I think it really sent, it focuses your attention on the action versus all the muddy gray and brown cars that are surrounding it.
Right.
Well, I think that's all it is. There's nothing comic booky about it, but it's filmic. It's cinematographic. The idea that the first time you see this yellow taxi in the frame, you know, it's going to be important. It's like, you know, it's like the girl in the red coat in Schindler's List. It draws the eye immediately, and you know, okay, that's what I'm going to look at now, and properly so.
And it gives us a really interesting prop for the minute immediately following this too. We'll be talking about in our next episode.
Yes, the one short note on Lucky Star: the back door lists a phone number. And Hal, I know you remember from doing the Rocketeer Minute when we talked to Danny Bilson that they snuck in the number of the mailbox was their extension at Warner Bros.
That's right.
So I'm just wondering who at Paramount has extension 3290. it's dialed CL6-3290. So somewhere on the Paramount lot, somebody's getting a phone call.
There's one way to find out.
Yeah, I know. But, let me speak to extension 3290. It's probably the art director's Or it could be HR, who knows?
Right, could be HR. One thing, just to circle back real quick, our mystery man in the car with the fedora, I have confirmed he is not James Whitmore, even though he reminds me of him. But Whitmore had been dead for 2 years when this movie came out. So there's one we can check off the list.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if anybody else saw the resemblance somehow.
One character actor down, hundreds to go.
Yeah. Hundreds to go.
I appreciate that research on the fly, though. This is what's so good about this podcast. Yeah, we make a totally unsupported assertion, and we check it out right away.
Right. And we remain inconclusive. But that's the kind of service we provide.
It's impressive. I'm really impressed by the number of flips that cab does. I know that, you know, it's probably some of it's CGI, some of it, you know, and a lot of it's real. I remember watching a behind the scenes for Superman the Motion Picture, the 1978 version, where they had to flip an Impala, and they actually built a large spring that would they wound up the spring. And as the car was unmanned driving down the street, they had a device that would detonate and loosen the spring, and the spring would actually flip the car. And they filmed it with several cameras, so that even though it only flipped once, they would cut every time it hit, you know, the upside down, the upside down position, and make it look like there's another loop of it.
You could do that with an Impala.
Yeah,
I'm reminded that your story reminds me of a behind the scenes piece I saw on, I think it was the first Indiana Jones movie, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, in which they had to flip a large truck. And in fact, it's the truck that Indy thinks is carrying Marion's when she's in the big basket. He thinks, and then the truck is hit and flips. And they explained how they flipped it was they basically in the back of the truck had a chunk of telephone pole that at the right moment was shot down through the bottom of the truck. And ejected it, you know, more or less sprang like a pole vaulter, put this truck up in the air. And if you watch the movie, you can actually see that pole come out of the bottom of the truck. It's part of the carnage of this truck going over. It's like, what's that telephone pole doing there? That's what made it go over. It's fascinating the things they used to dare to do in the days before CGI, and still do, but. Stunt men, stunt drivers, the people who rig these things are just so clever.
Right. And it harkens back to the days of the A-Team, where there's a car chase, somebody shoots at the bad guy, and, you know, bad guy swerves behind a parked car where, unbeknownst to us, there's a perfect ramp that sends the right two wheels up so that it can go over. But, you know, it worked. It was convincing. There's a traveling exhibit of James Bond vehicles and props that I've seen a couple of times. And one of the most striking was the, I mean, didn't mean as much to me nostalgic wise, but it was crazy to see in person, was the Aston Martin Vanquish, which I think was in at the end of Casino Royale, where they set a record, and the stunt driver, I think he rolled it 19 times.
Wow.
It's just unbelievable. And this, this shell of a car. And if I remember right, it was also done with a Ram, but I to this day, I can't imagine. You know, that guy's head is still rattling. It's got to be.
Yeah. Amazing that a human being was in there doing that. Yeah. Fantastic. And, you know, what's neat is even in the days of, you know, the Captain America movie or since, there's still a place for real stunts. I mean, the Uber example these days, I guess, is Tom Cruise, who does all his own stuff, famously clinging to the side of aircraft and stuff like that.
Right.
There's still a place for that. And I think moviegoers can detect the difference. I really think people can tell still when something doesn't look or feel right in CGI. The physics just isn't right. The way that people move and act and land just isn't right. CGI is awful good, and it'll fool you. But sometimes there's just nothing like doing it for real. Still.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right. I think even if you can't articulate, you know, what the difference is to your eye between one or the other, you there is an instinctive level where you know, even if you can't explain it. And it's interesting you mentioned physics, and of course I see that all the time with, you know, anything aviation related. There's some key mistakes that a lot of CGI animators make, even if they get the details of it just right. It's the movements that are wrong. But like thinking back, you know, not to pile on a much maligned character who I didn't quite deserve as bad as he got, but thinking back to Star Wars Episode One and Jar Jar Binks, the one thing that struck me about him was, and Brian, you're the physicist, you can probably explain this better than I can. It's somewhere around inertia, momentum, acceleration, somewhere in that family. But like when he would jump and then when he would land, and you do see this in other characters, but there's this moment, like the last third of his flight, it's like he's suddenly being sucked to the ground. Like he's artificially being accelerated and being like pulled in almost like by magnets or something. And it just throws off your whole sense of this being a, you know, a real character having, you know, having mass and momentum and inertia and all those other things.
It's an interesting observation. I share it. Jar Jar felt light to me. Like the character looks like he should weigh about, you know, 250, 300 pounds. He's 8 feet tall and whatever. And he didn't move like that. He didn't land like that. He was, he felt too light to me. And it puts me in mind of, and again, taking nothing away from the modern generation of computer animators, but these are lessons that people knew back in the early Disney days and the early Warner Brothers days was how to give an animated character volume and mass. And, you know, when one part of a body stops, the whole body doesn't stop. Other, you know, parts of it, keep the jowls or the ears or whatever, will move, keep moving a little further. These are lessons people had learned and applied very well in the 30s, 40s, and 50s that I sometimes wonder if those fundamentals of animation have been forgotten because CGI just looks so darn good. And again, I am not a computer animator. I've never done it. So maybe somebody listening who knows the field would say, you idiot. Of course that's what they, but sometimes I don't see it. Sometimes I don't see it in the modern product.
I agree.
One thing I want to point out, and I think you know that I'm a bridge guy. I love bridges. I love all kinds of bridges. And we see one in the background here as it keeps going. Well, we never actually see the bridge itself, but we see the hardware of the holding it up. And I think what they were trying to infer, and it's probably something that's in Liverpool where they were filming the very end of this scene, even though the street scene takes place in Manchester, this end scene is taking place at the Albert Docks in Liverpool. There's what looks like the edges of a bascule bridge, which is a large counterweighted bridge that will swing up and down. It has a huge counterweight on one side of it and an enormous truss that's holding it up. And you just, it's basically a giant lever. And I mean, it's an amazing way of working. There's two little control towers at the top of it. Hal, I know you've been to Chicago a number of times. There's that big bridge over the Chicago River that it goes next to the Merchandise Mart, I think.
Yeah. I know that's the one too.
Yeah. That's a bascule bridge. It has an enormous counterweight. And to see these things operate, it's just amazing. I'm sorry they couldn't, you know, it had to be in the down position where it was here just so we could see it. But it's just such a beautiful piece of engineering. Just seeing it kind of waving to us in the background with that big cement weight on top of it is just a nice moment. You can see it when the Lucky Star door is spinning around in the background there.
Now you've got me really curious as to where that actually is.
Yeah. And I mean, it could have, I mean, it kind of, even though it's Brooklyn, this is very geographically fuzzy. I'm assuming it, you know, it is the East River, but those types of bridges, although most of them have been replaced now because there's no real traffic on the Gowanus Canal, which kind of follows along to the east of the East River. But the Gowanus Canal used to have several bascule bridges going over it. And those were common in, you know, in the five boroughs that they used these counterweighted bridges. For one thing, they didn't use a lot of energy. You had a motor that would turn it, but it didn't have, you know, you could use like a small electric motor rather than a big thing that had to lift it.
Because of that balance and that counterweight, right? So it can take a lot of force.
Yeah.
To
so it does work as a thing. I think we've pretty much beaten this minute into submission. But I look forward to talking some more about. We're going to have some interesting guests. Actually, we're going to have an upcoming guest in the next minute or two that's going to be showing up with some interesting tales about this part of the filming. But I do want to thank our audience to be a part of this. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe. Leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. Be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.